unfinished business, a modern piece of glasswork. Down on the corner that you walk each day in passing, the elderly sales clerk won't ask with suspicion. The whole of Motor Corporation's giving its permission.
Hello, welcome to the newest episode of the Film Stage Podcast. I am Jordan Raup.
And I'm Dan Mecca.
And today we're going to be talking about a little news, and we are going to review Daybreakers, Youth in Revolt, and Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones. So, this past couple weeks, there's been a hell of a lot of news, and,
hell yeah.
And last night, actually, massive news story broke, and that is Spider-Man. Now, there's been a lot of talk of Spider-Man 4. Sam Raimi has been working on it, he's been working on the script, and there's
been about 1,000 drafts of the script, apparently.
And so, there was rumors, you know, Tobey Maguire said he was ready to return, then there's rumors that John Malkovich was going to play a villain.
Vulture, which would have been awesome.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway was even rumored, which is
for, what, Black Widow or something.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but so last night, Nikki Fink and her newly acquired friend, Mike Fleming, from Variety, they broke news that Spider-Man 4 is completely scrapped, and that Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire are going to move on to other things, but then they also announced that they are going to plan a reboot, which will come out
the same time.
Yeah, 2012. Now, the reboot is going to focus on, they said it's going to be a little gritty,
and it's going to,
yeah, it's going to get dirty.
My question about gritty and Spider-Man is how do you make Spider-Man gritty?
Is it going to be like a Batman Begins type, like, you know?
Well, because the thing about Batman is that Batman is inherently a dark comic book character, so, you know, I mean, and this is obviously, when you look at Bryan Singer and Superman Returns, that was one of the bigger problems was, you know, Bryan Singer made what I think was a respectable homage and almost like a continuation of the Richard Donner Superman movies, but he didn't do what Nolan did with Batman Begins, which is make it darker. But then how do you make Superman darker? And I feel like Spider-Man is more like Superman than he's like Batman. And I don't, I mean, how much more dark could you get than Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3? What do you think? I don't know.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, James Vanderbilt.
Right, and he's a good writer, too. Yeah. I mean,
The news story made it sound like he had there was a script that he wrote, and they, like, kind of, Sony was waiting to see if Sam Raimi was going to produce anything, and now...
Right, which it seems like Sony had their bases covered, kind of, which is funny when you think about it.
They were just waiting. Like, literally, as soon as they announced Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi, they had a press release saying, yep, we already have a script, we're going to go into production soon.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, screenplay... Screenplay quotes aren't, I mean, they're high in layman's terms, but, terms, you know, giving James Vanderbilt however much money to, you know, pump out a draft of a possible reboot probably wasn't that much of a big deal.
When the news broke, it was more shocking than I was kind of pissed off, because I think if they, I mean, I, they haven't announced who's directing, they haven't announced the cast, so I think there's a possibility.
Yeah.
But it makes it seem like they're kind of going back, you know, Devin Frost wrote an article on Shud about how they're kind of catering to the Twilight audience.
Now, here's the thing. I was going to actually, like, kind of tweet Devin Frost about this. I mean, you know, not that he would have really cared what I had to say, but I didn't like that article because it makes a lot of...
assumptions.
Lot of assumptions. And I mean, you know, hey, listen, I get the whole... Yes, I mean, I agree. Yeah, at one point he says it's essentially, you know, it's essentially Sony giving up and saying, okay, do over, you know, like, and all that stuff. But I mean, he writes the article kind of not ever acknowledging that Spider-Man 3 was a poorly crafted film, right? So, I mean, that's one thing. And, you know, even though it was a box office success. And then he makes these assumptions for some reason that the next trilogy is going to be like a Twilight movie, and then people are like, oh, how long until Taylor Lautner becomes the next Spider-Man? And listen, I mean, hey, those are all sentiments that I can definitely get behind, but we don't know anything. Like, I mean, you know... The only thing we do know is
Entertainment Weekly had this little, like, quote, if you will, of possible directors, and here are the three that they named. 500 Days of Summer director, Mark Webb, is leading up to the big one. Seabiscuit director, Gary Ross, and then Michael Bay. Himself.
The Michael Bay.
Yeah, and, you know, Michael Bay's biggest fan, unfortunately, writes for a website, Meryl Barr, and he said he told me that that Michael Bay will never do superhero movie. That's what he said. I guess.
Did Meryl, well, if Meryl said that.
Yeah, but I mean, I told Meryl Michael Bay will do whatever a studio tells him to.
Well, I mean, don't forget. I mean, James Cameron wrote a Spider-Man draft, draft to Spider-Man. So, you know, and that I mean, that's kind of something to remember, and you know why that never got made. Probably because the script required a $1 billion budget or something like that. But I mean, I guess I'd be interested to see Mark Webb's version.
But see, it seems like I mean, if you look at his music videos and you look at Five Nights at Summer, it doesn't seem like it'll be a gritty Superman.
Well, that's
he can take in that direction every once, but like he hasn't done gritty, really. He's done.
I mean, well, and what's funny about those three directors is how ungritty they all are. Like, you know, Gary Ross, I have nothing against Gary Ross, but Seabiscuit is probably his most acclaimed film. I can't remember what else he's done. But I remember that he's done other things that aren't really they're not bad. But I mean nothing that screams gritty realism or what else we got going?
Pleasantville,
which is really actually one of the best movies of the '90s. That movie is great. But once again, not gritty. You know, it's so. Yeah, I mean, and Michael Bay obviously has literally not a gritty bone in his body, so I don't really know. I think Sony's kind of trying to clean up their own mess.
Dude, get Catherine Hardwick.
Catherine Hardwick could do it. Maybe David Slade. It seems like he'll do anything for a buck. I don't know. I mean,
I mean, we got to find out soon if it's coming out 2012. We got to find out.
What do you think? Okay, so like just quickly getting back. Once again, I didn't really agree with Devin Franchi's sentiments. Or just really in general, the general public sentiments. I think James Roki, who I'm a big fan of, he writes for AMC and Netflix and all this. He tweeted how he thinks it's the best move for Raimi and Maguire, and he'd rather see them do their own work than be under servitude. And like I think that's the most important thing. I want Raimi to make the Warcraft movie. I want him
exactly.
I want him to make. I don't know, another Drag Me to Hell 2, whatever. Yeah, just something
Evil
that
Dead
he,
4.
Right, exactly. Something that he's passionate about. And Maguire, I think, you know, he has a ways to go, but he will. I mean, he has the chops to play roles that are better than Peter Parker. So, yeah. I mean, whatever. Who cares? I mean, but anyway, what I was getting to is, will other companies now, other than Sony, if let's say that's I personally do not think the movie will come out in 2012. I think it'll get delayed because it just seems ridiculous. But because it's already 2010, but will other companies start doing this? And Fox with Fantastic Four, they already plan this. And what I find funny is people didn't go as crazy up in the arms about. Well, I guess because it wasn't as much of a success.
Really cared. I mean, the first two Spider-Man films are two of my favorites.
Great, yeah, no, they're great movies.
But I mean, it didn't work with Incredible Hulk.
True, I hate The Incredible Hulk, actually. Yeah. I don't hate it, but I do not like it. Yeah. But see, a lot of people disagree with you, and me. A lot of people think The Incredible Hulk, the Louis Letter movie, is...
I thought it was fun. I don't hate it.
See, I dislike it almost as much as the first Hulk. But I mean... but yeah, you're right. So for example, is that a reboot?
Yeah.
It is, right? So like... It's already been going on, so it's kind of like this Spider-Man news doesn't really seem, when you really think about it, as controversial or as, like, up in the arms raising. Yeah. And also, who mentioned this? Drew at HitFlix, I think, was kind of in, like, a debate on Twitter with Devin Franchi, and he made a good point, and he said comics live by the reboot. You know, if you look at actual comics, you have like Spider-Man during the Cold War, Spider-Man if he's bad, you know, Superman versus Batman, you know, all this stuff. Like,
yeah, I think the span between Batman and Robin and Batman Begins was only 6 years, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah. You know, like you have Batman Year One, which is Frank Miller's origin story, but then you have all these other origin stories. And so, I mean...
Just wait for more news.
I mean, right, you know, let's say Mark Webb turns out a great Spider-Man movie. I mean, are we going to lambast him for? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I would direct a Spider-Man movie if someone gave me the money. So I don't know.
Yeah. So I mean, we'll be looking forward. Definitely keep tuned to the film stage. We'll provide you with updates. I'm sure they'll be happening soon.
Yeah.
All right. Now segueing into
superheroes,
superheroes
to a human superhero.
James Franco, who was
James Franco? Yeah, that's who the Human Superhero was.
So Danny Boyle, his follow up after Slumdog Millionaire. We were waiting. Finally, a couple months ago, it announced it was going to be 127 Hours,
which written
was,
by Simon Beaufoy,
same screenwriter behind
Slumdog.
And so this is his next film. It's based on the story of Aaron Ralston, the guy who was in the 2003 hiking accident, and he had to cut off his arm
with a, what was it,
dull, like a knife.
A dull knife.
Yeah. And so we were waiting. Ryan Gosling was rumored to play the
lead. I was very excited about.
But then James Franco got announced.
Which is fine.
Yeah, it was just small. We just wanted to share and how we thought, what we think. So Dan, what do you think of James Franco?
Well, I mean, the story itself is interesting. Kind of in the vein of Touching the Void. That kind of a thing, in the vein of Vertical Limit. Real life stories are always interesting or on it. You know what I mean? There's always risky. Risky because of how unrisky they are. Because there's already essentially a narrative in place.
Yeah.
But this seems like an interesting one because of how Danny Boyle said he was going to shoot it, and we said, an hour of no dialogue, which is kind of fascinating and all that stuff. So, and also Danny Boyle, even in his failures, makes it interesting. A movie like The Beach, which is just, in many ways a disaster, is interesting to watch just because of how bad it is, right? So, and James Franco has established himself as a viable acting force, so, as General Hospital shows.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's cool that he's, he's starting to, because this is obviously going to be, I think, it's going to get released around wintertime, and it's going to be huge, like, Oscar, especially for Best Actor.
Yeah, I would think.
The movie is James Franco, it's
right, be, I mean, it's all him, yeah, so.
And, yeah, I mean, we saw him in Milk and
Pineapple Express. He's great in Milk, great in Pineapple Express, obviously,
I'm glad he's branching out.
We'll also see kind of his ability to do real again in Howl, which is premiering at Sundance. He plays Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah. And then Your Highness, he's also in it.
Right, which is the David Gordon Green follow-up. So, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, so production on that starts soon, and then it's going to come out hopefully wintertime with Fox Searchlight behind it again.
That'd be great.
All right, let's get to our first review. Now, this is a film I saw, 4 months ago in Toronto Film Festival at midnight.
The first night.
Yeah, after watching 5 films, so...
No. So, your memory's
a little rusty. Hazy. No, this film gave me a lot to remember. No, so, this is Daybreakers. This is the new vampire film by the Spierig Brothers, yeah. Just a quick background for those who have not heard of it. It's just, the film takes place in 2019, and a plague, has transformed all these humans into vampires, and there's few humans living. And the whole story is kind of about blood supply and how what it would a realistic right. approach or what it would look like and what it would be if.
Yeah, it's about diminishing resources. You can apply it to anything.
Yeah, and Willem Dafoe, Sam Neill, Ethan Hawke,
Isabel Lucas.
Yes,
is in it for 5 minutes. Spoilers.
Yes. Now I
just so you all know.
Now I this was a perfect Midnight Madness movie for Toronto.
Right, okay.
And people went, from the first.
And I did not see it in Midnight Madness. Yeah. Jordan did.
From the opening credits to where
the bat flies up. Yeah.
Flies up and then just even to the end. There's a shot at the end that's we can talk about later. But just this is a great addition to
vampire lore.
Vampire lore that has not seen that many great additions in the last
recently. And what I think is funny about this movie is that this story actually has not been told before in the terms of vampire mythology, which I think is kind of interesting, because it's really not that... if you were sitting around with your friends, you'd be like, dude, like, what if the world was all vampires? It seems kind of simple, and it is. It is very simple. It's essentially I Am Legend drawn out. It's I Am Legend with a civilization. Right, it's pretty much, and the vampires aren't zombie vampires. They're people that just happen to have a bloodlust and fangs, right? So and can't go out in daylight.
Yeah.
But what I like is it takes this kind of crazy alternate reality, whatever, and brings it to its logical conclusion. It thinks everything through. It develops inventions for how if you were a vampire living and working, how you would drive to work, how you would deal with the sunlight. And so, and they have implementations that are all very interesting and also very simple. And the fact that they did it all for $20 million, it looks like it cost $50 million at least. And, you know, I think this is also a good example of a movie of the future in the sense that it looks like it cost more than it did.
Yeah,
and because it cost less than it did, you know, less than it looks like it did, it would have made around $15.5 million at the box office. So it's a success. I mean, assuming it makes, if it drops, you know, the usual amounts, it'll make, you know, $35 million. That's a success, you know, and so Lionsgate can hold their heads high, and so can the Spirit Brothers. So, I mean, it's a testament to definitely that. But, yeah, I mean, the story's good. I think that Willem Dafoe and Sam Neill respectively steal the movie, I would argue.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah. And I like how you talk about logic, because when I remember seeing this film, a little rusty, but, like, there's a scene towards the end where they explain a process they have to go through and if you see the film, like, there's just, like, little hints and different, like, details that you can catch in the film. That,
I mean, I would say everything's a bit oversimplified. Like, there are scenes that happen. There's a scene of, like, revelation in the movie, which I won't, we can talk about maybe later, but Ethan Hawke figures something out, and when it happens, it seems like, because it's one of these things where all these people, there's this group of humans that are hiding out, you can tell that from the trailer, and then Ethan Hawke comes to realize this, and he figures something out using the human resources that the humans haven't yet figured out, and it doesn't really make sense because the humans know everything that Ethan Hawke knows, and even though he's a scientist, he's a hemologist or whatever a blood scientist. And even though like he is, the way he figures out to do this one specific thing that's like imperative to the plot of the film, that really has nothing to do with being a blood scientist. So you're kind of like, well, was it that hard for everyone else to figure it out? So stuff like that was a little simple. And then, you know, towards the end, there's another thing. But the point is, it's thought out, you know, and simplification I can forgive, obviously, because they don't balk at their own conclusions for like a happy ending or something like that. So I really appreciated that a lot, you know, and so, and also that the Spirit Brothers did the special effects.
Right. Yeah.
And so that, you know, so, I mean, you know, we can talk about that for a minute, but.
Yeah, I thought I really liked the creature designs, the way they were terribly frightening.
So just to kind of clean up what we're talking about. So the whole thing is the world's vampires, there aren't many humans, vampires need blood, animals and humans are running out of things. And that was another cool thing, like there were these scenes in fields where there's just like kind of an ominous silence because there's not a lot of birds, there's not a lot of anything because they're all being farmed for their blood. So what's happening is because there's no blood, Ethan Hawke, Sam Neill is the president of this company that essentially supplies blood, but there's no more blood, and Ethan Hawke is the head hemologist, and they're running out of blood, and so he's working on a blood substitute, Ethan Hawke, and his name is, I don't even know what his name is, it's
Edward
Dalton. Edward Dalton, that's right, Edward
Team
Dalton.
Edward.
That's right. That's funny. I didn't think about that. Right. So Edward Dalton, Ethan Hawke, and he's working on a blood substitute. But what's happening is, obviously vampires don't die, right? So that's another thing they had to get past. What happens when there's no blood? And what happens is they become subsiders, which are essentially real-life bats, like are human-sized bats.
Yeah.
And it's all like, and it's just like awesome watching the transformation. And they're like underneath the subway.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
And it's just, it's cool. Like, it's really, really cool. It reminded me a lot of, it reminded me a lot, and they must have taken inspiration from this, the H.G. Wells novel, The Time Machine. Because in The Time Machine, in the future, there's two sets of beings, and it's, I can't remember the names, but it's essentially these very naive, like, land people who just are, like, kind of Aryan, blonde, and just like, da-da-da-da-da. And then there are these, essentially, like, golem-like ogres underneath the earth who, they pretty much make everything run, and almost the happy medium of those, this world is every once in a while they'll come out from the ground and grab one of these other like naive creatures and eat them, you know, and that's kind of what ends up getting broken up in The Time Machine. But anyway, it's a lot like that, and then so that's what's happening in Daybreakers, and Willem Dafoe is I guess the supporting protagonist to Sam Neill's awesome antagonist, and his name is Elvis, and he's awesome. And then we can
talk that's why I think Sam Neill, Willem Dafoe, and Ethan Hawke all knew what kind of film
all recognize that this is more than just like Twilight. Yeah. Bloodlust.
Yeah, and, you know what I mean? they make the film fun. You know, each of their performances. I thought Sam Neill was a little wasted, but I could have been wrong. I mean, that was
I would have appreciated like one more scene.
Or the what I had a problem with was his daughter, the whole him and his daughter. But it was kind of weird.
If you felt that way. Well, the thing about this movie, which is funny, is it's 85 minutes long. I mean, it's 90 minutes with 5 minutes of credits. So. It's great almost because it's like this is the kind of movie you don't want to spend more than an hour and a half, even though it's a fun movie. I don't really want to spend 2 hours and 15 minutes like watching a fun movie. I'd rather spend like 85 minutes. So I appreciated it, but at the same time, I felt like if they had 10 more minutes, they could have really, because there's a whole thing like Isabel Lucas, who is the robot alien girl from Transformers 2 in the beginning. Very talented individual. she plays Sam Neill's daughter, who refused to turn into a vampire, and she like ran away in the beginning of the epidemic. And no one knows where she is. Everyone thinks she's dead. Yeah. Spoilers, because she's in the movie. She's actually not dead, obviously. So there's this whole subplot with him and his daughter that was a little rushed.
Yeah.
I guess with 5 more minutes it would have been better. But I mean,
I would say check it out. It's fun. It's a fun.
Yeah, movie. No, I mean it was a good movie. Ethan Hawke. I was a little disappointed. Ethan Hawke. It seemed a little bit like he was going through the motions. I don't know. He does one thing really well, and I guess he was kind of just on autopilot. Willem Dafoe, who's just the man.
Yeah,
he just is. He's just the man. The fact that he can be an Antichrist
and Fantastic Mr. Fox
and Fantastic Mr. Fox and this all within like months of release is just like mind blowing.
It's crazy, but, yeah. So I'd say check it out. Definitely, it's
definitely
fun.
Check it out.
All right. Now moving on, this film, Youth in Revolt. This is Weinstein's company. This is they were gonna release this. I remember last February. Seriously, it was filmed 2 years ago, and I remember putting it on a list of movies that are coming out in February, and like they were
of last year,
and then it was definitely supposed to come out in October, and then when Inglourious Basterds did really well, they pushed it to spread out their revenue. And so so now it's finally hitting theater. It hit theater January 8th,
and then obviously 9, which I mean, that you need to really increase. You got to devote a lot of time to that movie.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Based on its epic success.
Yeah. Now this is people love this book, Youth in Revolt. People I've talked to.
Yeah, I've got a friend who just worships it.
Yeah, written by C.D. Payne.
Right.
And but this was adapted by Miguel Arteta.
Ortega.
Yeah. Yeah, and it kind of tells the story of Michael Cera plays Nick Twisp, this youth who his
revolting youth.
Yeah, and his parents are divorced, and he lives with his mom,
Jean Smart.
Yes, and she has a boyfriend.
Many boyfriends.
Yes. Well, it starts out with one boyfriend, and
Zach Galifianakis,
and she's very openly sexual, and which affects Nick. I think.
Yeah, well, the whole thing's about sex, and so, I mean, he even says at one point in the narration, everybody around him is getting action, his father, who's played by Steve Buscemi.
His girlfriend was the girl from Nick and Nora, that puked in a toilet.
Get out of here. Said, yeah, wow, that is really interesting. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's funny.
And, and so... But,
so he's getting sex from this young hottie, who's the girl from Nick and Nora, puked, and apparently, and, and then his mom's having a lot of sex, and the only one who's not having sex is his best friend, of course. And they're talking about how they're gonna have sex, and I mean, it's like 40-year-old virgin. It's the 16-year-old virgin.
Yeah, and so they Zach Galifianakis sells a car to a group of sailors. And
it doesn't work.
It doesn't go over. So they have to escape to this town.
Was it there's a banana in the transmission?
and there he meets Portia
Sheeny.
Played by Portia Doubleday. That's her name.
He's got a great name. Portia Doubleday.
Wow.
Any relation to Doubleday books? Doubleday,
I don't know. But anyway, so they, so he kind of falls in love with her instantly.
As all 16-year-olds do.
Yeah. Now, Dan, a lot of people, when I talk about this movie, they kind of are tired of Michael Cera.
Yes.
Now, do you think this will change people's minds?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, people say, it's funny. I feel like people say this about every comedian. And I kind of have a problem with it because they're like, oh, Michael Cera, just plays the same role in every movie. And, okay, yes. And, like, and Will Ferrell gets a lot of that, too.
And I think
Will,
in, like, a year, it's gonna, you think Zach Galifianakis could possibly fall in
that? Right, like, I feel like it happens to everybody. You know, yeah. Like, before you know it, people will be like, oh, Zach Galifianakis plays the same role in every movie. You know, people, Eddie Murphy, you know, back when people cared about him, you know, oh, Eddie Murphy plays the same role in every movie. Like, you know, when he was making all the Beverly Hills Cops and all this. And, okay, yes, but, like, you know, Ethan Hawke plays the same role in every movie. I mean, I love him, but he plays the same role in every movie. Like, most actors, if you actually look at their kind of body of work, they play similar roles because, like any business, you know, if it's not so broke, don't fix it. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, Harrison Ford has been accused literally his entire career of playing the same character. And even though I think that he's a great performer, I can sympathize. So my kind of thing is, I mean, yeah, welcome to the club, Michael Cera. That's kind of the way I think of it. But at the same time, okay, just that aside, this is not much different from his other roles. Yeah, but at the same time, it's a much better role than the one in Year One, his role in Year One. I think it's a lot better than his role in Nick and Nora.
Yeah, okay.
Which I did not really enjoy that movie. I just thought he was kind of wasted a little bit. This is just a much more rounded character, probably, yeah. Because
and the comedy is a lot more, you know, it's vulgar and it's a lot more
right,
clever.
It's rated R, you know, and it's yeah. And it's pretty much all him, which is nice because usually I feel like he's almost been sheltered by other stars in a lot of his movies or other performers. So it's cool because he's doing this by himself. He gets to play two roles, his Tyler Durden, you know, if you will, is this who he makes up to impress Sheenie. His name is Francois Dillinger, and he's funny as hell. I mean, yeah, it was a funny movie, you know, and you know, really, and is it like other Michael Cera movies? Yes, but it's different enough that I feel like you'll walk out not saying Michael Cera makes the same movies.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it. So.
I really love this movie. I thought it was hilarious. I think definitely Michael Cera. Superbad I loved, but since Arrested Development, this is my favorite. Like my favorite film or favorite property
aside from Superbad.
Yeah, I love Superbad.
Superbad is definitely. I mean, that's a solid film.
And I think this comedy is kind of clever, kind of, you know, like Arrested
Development. Yeah, no, I mean.
And, I'm really actually interested to read the book because I heard the book's even more vulgar than.
Yeah, I mean, just from talking to people about it, it seems like. I mean, but obviously, like a lot of things, the book just there's more.
Yeah.
But one thing I really liked about this movie, which I almost wish, and I read a review, you know, I might just be getting this from the review I read. I can't remember. It might have been the New Yorker review of it. That I like how Sheenie and Nick are really, like, they're pseudo-intellectual 16-year-old, 17-year-old people. And it just, what I liked about it is, I remember being that age and thinking of myself, at least a little bit in that light. Like, I knew who people were that other people didn't know. Like, I knew who authors were, like, maybe foreign
Breathless.
Authors. Right. Yeah, they mentioned Breathless, like, so I knew that movie. Stuff like that, where you're like, oh, well, you know, one of his first lines is, I'm a reader of, like, you know, renowned literature and stuff. And he's got all these books. But, like, yeah. you get the feeling that he really hasn't read many of them. And, like, when him and Sheenie talk about these great artists and these, like, authors, you get the feeling that they're just kind of, they're book sleeving it, you know, with the conversation. They're, like, critic commenting, copy and pasting it, you know.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that because that is the way. I mean, when you're 16, how much time have you had to even read that shit? So it's, like, I like that, and I wish there was even a little bit more of it because it kind of forgets about it as the movie gets on.
I like the way they handled the relationship because, like, you know, it was his first love, and, like, it kind of reminded me when you're 16 and, like, he would do – I know they take it to greater lengths, but they
literally
do anything
literally, yeah.
to, like – because you think it's going to work. And I have experience, and I think –
Right, yeah.
And I think that they did a really good job portraying that, And of course, the movie gets crazier and crazier, and we can talk about some of the funny, like, gags, if you will, in the movie. But but in terms of, like, supporting cast, I think, you know, Fred Willard, it was nice. He's really
fine.
And Justin Long.
Playing a little bit of a different character, too, which was nice from Fred Willard. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't kind of just, dry humor. There was a lot of like physical humor and stuff, which is funny to see from him, just because, you know, of him. Who else did you say? Ray Liotta. Just always, just whatever. Yeah, I just love him in a movie, yeah, and whatever. Yeah. So there's someone else. Oh, Steve Buscemi. I liked a lot because he wasn't really funny, and that was just funny that he wasn't funny.
Yeah,
you know, in that movie. Yeah, and I'm trying to think. There were a couple of scenes that.
Do you want to talk? Let's go into spoilers.
We'll yeah, just talk we can about just go into spoilers quickly. Yeah, so just turn off this if you haven't seen.
Yeah, fast revolt. Forward.
Or fast forward rather. sorry. So
I mean, I really like the whole obviously everything involved with this car, like the
right.
That scene. Yeah. And
well, I like and how at the end he's like, I stole both of my parents' cars for you. Like that. That was. I mean, that's hysterical. Yeah, like, what you mean the scene where you try, the getaway scene?
Yeah.
When it hits the shallow water, that was, yeah, that's hysterical.
And I really like the mushroom, when they ate mushrooms, and they have the
oh, bowl. Justin Long.
Justin Long.
Maybe. Justin Long, I'm sorry, yeah, Justin Long, they helped, and, that was what I was thinking.
And he has this book, this Kama, is it Kama Sutra, or no,
it's a book like that, well, it's a sexual position book.
Yeah. And, you know, great animation.
That's right. I was going to mention that. There's a lot of really, like, funny, weird stop motion and then hand-drawn animation.
Oh, yeah. I wonder how you liked that.
I liked it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
It felt like, have you seen Paper Heart? They do. At the end of Paper Heart.
No,
did they? Spoiler. They have a stop motion at the end of that.
Really?
And, so kind of. That was another Michael Cera movie that I wasn't. When I first watched it, I liked it, but it wasn't, you know. But obviously, that was a smaller movie. That was.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that good? I mean,
it was okay. It was okay. Yeah. But they used the same, you know, stop motion things. But yeah, no, I like that. I liked the whole the scene in when they go to visit Portia at the French school,
he's talking to the girl in the bathroom.
Yeah, and then he runs back and gets the dog after he gets kicked out. Like he's like dodging.
Yeah, that back. Was then, yeah this dog that they get together.
What follows that with Fred Willard in the car and they're all naked.
He tells Fred Willard about that his friend is an illegal immigrant.
Yeah,
it's so funny. I mean. Yeah, it's a really funny movie, and I guess what I liked about it was that it didn't try to be more than the sum of its parts, you know, essentially. Like, I mean, the thing about this movie is, it's a small movie, in every sense of the word. Like, I wouldn't put it on any lists, you know, like, I don't see this being on my top 20 of 2010, you know, I mean, obviously, I don't know how I'll think of it in a month or something, but it's just one of those movies that knows what it is, and it does it, and it's not really trying to not trying to hit the ball out of the park, per se, but, you know, just a solid double, kind of a film, and so, I'm trying to think of some other really funny scenes. I loved Sheenie's parents. Religion obsessed parents. Yeah. That was all really funny. Oh, but like one part that was I just like thought belonged in a different movie was when towards the end he disguises himself as a girl. He disguises himself as a girl to go in to like get into Sheenie's house because her parents hate him, Nick, and he gets in really without a problem. And I was just kind of like, okay, I mean, whatever, move his story along, but it's kind of, you know, ridiculous, and, you know, I wonder how that was handled in the book, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe it was like that, I don't really, but.
Yeah, I mean, and with this whole, you know, other personality, the Dillinger, like, the scene, again, at the school that she was at when he's telling, you know, to wear, like, a crown and stuff on
it. Right, that was hysterical,
I'll take you, your belly button from the inside. From the inside. And, like, so, I know, there's just things I actually wasn't expecting that, you know, surprised me.
That were good. Yeah. And he was good. Michael Cera was really, really good. Yeah. So.
I think he's going to have a good year. Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, true. I cannot wait. Might be the peak year for Michael Cera, or just the beginning. Who knows?
Yeah. All right. So, definitely check out the movie.
Definitely.
All right.
Definitely check it out.
So, moving on. The last film we're going to talk about is Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones. Now.
Much talked about. Or much not talked about.
Yeah. Now, this film, it was supposed to go wide in December, and then due to some bad buzz, or mixed buzz.
Very smart move, I think.
They only opened it in 3 theaters, and then they're going to wait till this Friday, January 15th, to go wide.
Right.
And so...
Which I think is a good call.
This was supposed to be, I think, originally a small movie for Peter Jackson, and then I think...
Cost $100 million.
Well, no, but then Weta got involved, and they... Because I think a lot of those dream sequences were originally going to be...
I remember him talking about going to New Zealand to shoot the heaven scenes, which would imply... on location.
Yeah.
But then when I watched the movie, I was like, well, you didn't need to be in New Zealand. You could have just been in the studio to shoot the heaven scenes because it's all computer-generated imaging. So, I, you know.
Yeah, so this we can talk about kind of what we think about it later. But to start off, it's based on the Alice Sebold.
Right, Alice Sebold book.
Sebold book, which you read.
Of the same name.
Yeah.
Which I've read.
And it kind of it follows
enough us. To put down. I did not like the book. I don't, the prose, the writing is very, I don't want to say something that'll make me, it's very simple. It's very simply written and very kind of, it lacks, more, it's one note. It's told from Susie Salmon's, point of view, who's just died.
Right.
And it just kind of, I guess it reads like a 14-year-old writing it, but I just didn't appreciate that, so I don't know. It depends on how you read it. But anyway, keep going.
So. Yeah, so the film, like Dan said, follows this girl who, Susie Salmon, who has been murdered.
Right, murdered.
And, and so she kind of is living this between world,
She's in the between.
Yeah.
No, she's in the in-between.
Yeah.
Isn't that the line? She's in the in-between.
She's,
I never realized how weird that line is. She's in the yeah, but anyway, that's where she is.
Yeah,
so it's like pseudo purgatory, pseudatory, if you will. So
Mark Wahlberg plays her father,
Limbo, I guess actually. Yeah. But anyway, keep going.
Mark Wahlberg, who originally and should have been.
Oh yeah, so okay, so Ryan Mark Gosling. Wahlberg plays just the cast, right? Yeah. So Mark Wahlberg plays Jack Salmon, the father. Rachel Weisz plays something Salmon, the wife.
Abigail
Salmon. Sorry, it was never. Abigail Salmon,
Susan Sarandon
plays Grandma Lynn, she's kind of a stereotypical alcoholic grandmother, kind of a post-counterculture grandmother kind of a thing, which is fun.
Stanley Tucci
plays George Harvey, who, there's really no, not even worth spoilers, but he is the, he's George Harvey, who's the murderer.
And the best part of the movie.
The best part of the movie. And Michael Imperioli plays Len Fetterman, who is the, wasted role of the investigator, cop, who's trying to find the killer with Jack Salmon. Yeah, and Jack Salmon character was supposed to be played by Ryan Gosling in the very beginning, and then he gained weight for the role, and then showed up on set, and Peter Jackson said that he looked like he was wearing a fat suit because he had gained so much weight, and fired him, and then hired Mark Wahlberg, and mistake.
I agree. Now, this movie, you can watch it, and this is my opinion, and it's a fine movie to watch, but coming from something from Peter Jackson, I don't know, I didn't really connect with it too well, and I felt like, we can talk about it later, but I felt like, I don't know, there's a lot of things he tried to do that didn't really go together, so we can talk, like, I loved Stanley Tucci, and I thought Rachel Weisz was really good.
Yeah, she was good.
And
the thing about the way, like, the movie, you're right, the movie is definitely kind of like a poorly structured movie, but it had its work cut out for it because it is, I mean, it's kind of like in the way To Kill a Mockingbird, the book is a very strange structured book, and people always say it's a masterpiece in its own right, but it's essentially two short novellas that are kind of put together because you have the story of the family, of Atticus Finch and his family, and then you have the story, and then you have this like other story about the trial, and then about Boo Radley. So I mean, so then there's a trial, and then there's the kids, and Atticus Finch is a character in both, and Boo Radley's in character kind of in both, So and then they all kind of mash together at the end, but really it's a messy setup, and The Lovely Bones is a lot like that because it's like. Because it's a drama, it's a family drama, but it's also a murder mystery. But but the reader knows who the killer is from literally page. On the book, it's like page 13 or even earlier, and in the movie, it's like minute 13. Not minute 13. It's like minute 30.
Yeah, because I actually saw this movie twice, and my family wanted to see it again. So if you look in the beginning, there's a lot of details. Like you see Stanley Tucci, in the beginning of the film, he says, "My killer was there watching. If I wasn't so obsessed with it." She had this kid at school that likes her, and she likes and Stanley Tucci's there. You can see him
watching.
Yeah, watching. And that's cool. That's interesting. There's little touches like that. Like I thought. there's some great like lighting setups, like especially
yeah,
when
no,
she
yeah, I agree.
When she murdered. Oh, and that was going to ask you. In the book, she's raped, right?
And they don't, I have to. This is the thing. I don't want to say that's what happened.
My cousin said that, so she.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. But I like I said, I didn't read the entire thing because I didn't enjoy it, so. But I read enough to know that, and I'm pretty sure. But okay, so we'll take your cousin's word for it. And yes, I guess she was raped and murdered.
But I understand.
And,
I mean, he wanted to go PG-13, so I don't.
Right, and I honestly at first I was a little because at first for what they show in the beginning I was a little disgruntled. I was like, oh come on, you know, like da da da. But by the end, I had no problem with how he handled it actually. And it's a pretty violent PG-13 for what it's worth. Violent enough, you know, and I mean, just to kind of respond to your feelings about the movie, I definitely liked it more than you. I liked it a lot more than I thought it would, just based on how I responded to the book and then the trailer, which I didn't really appreciate. And for me, the least engaging parts of the book or of the movie rather was the narration that's taken from the book, because one. I didn't feel it was really necessary. I mean, all the narration is kind of window dressing, just like frosting. And I guess I appreciate if it's a $100 million movie, people haven't seen the book, want a little bit of, you know, a little bit of pandering, I guess, or something like that. Okay. But that doesn't mean I have to like the writing when it's spoken, you know what I mean? And I don't still. So I didn't really like the narration, and that was my least favorite part. And it's funny because similarly to the book, my least favorite parts were the heaven sequences.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I thought they went all out, like, you know what I mean, and too much in a sense with right. the heaven sequences.
But then
like,
also not
liked,
enough because
I don't know, like,
I mean.
There's this montage, like, when they go sledding, and then, like, they're dancing around, and, like, it looked pretty, but, like, it wasn't an interesting portrayal.
And also, but, like, this, but and what's funny is, it's true to the book, which is a criticism, because, it doesn't make really, when you think about it, it doesn't really make much sense. You know, heaven's been portrayed in all these different ways, and usually always, I mean, even in Paradise Lost, John Milton's poem, heaven is very boring because it's like, you know, okay, you get there and you're happy, right? That's like the whole thing. And so it's really always been kind of a flawed, you know, interpretation of heaven, which is always ironic, obviously. But like, this is one of the most flawed. And in her book, it is too, because they don't even really try. I mean, she gets to heaven in the book, just like she does in the movie, or like the pseudo heaven, and which she never really explains. And it's like, whatever you think. And whatever you love, you have. And just like in the book, in the movie, scenes like that, it's very shallow stuff. It's like she's like, you know, sledding and you know, getting her picture taken in these like magazines and stuff. And it rings false.
Yeah, that whole scene was so weird.
Like,
I was like,
you're just like, yeah. If I go to heaven, and I'm sure that if pretty much everybody goes to heaven, and you're like your true conception of happiness, you know, like not what you think, but like what your true conception inside would be. It would be, you know, like, you know. Relations. It would be feelings, and
it felt boring. Like she was walking around a world that was
right. And then 20 minutes after that, she's not really in heaven.
Yeah.
She's in the in between thing where she's like watching her father and trying to solve her murder.
What was up with her friend? That kind of like when she touched her, she could see her, and then they don't really
right. And there's
go
this girl who's kind of got this
supernatural
Haley Joel Osment thing going on, but see, this is the thing. This is all from the book. Right, and I'm not saying I'm not trying to make Peter Jackson get off the hook here, but there's a lot to filter out, and I feel like, you know, nowadays where, you know, all these faithful adaptations are just, I mean, so faithful going on here. I mean, from Watchmen to Where the Wild Things Are, it's interesting. I mean, it's just interesting to kind of see how sometimes it can be. As I believe also in the case of Watchmen 2, and the wild, where the wild things are for that matter, a hindrance as much if not more than a benefit. So, But though, because I did really enjoy this movie, I loved some of the acting. Rachel Weisz was incredible, I thought. I mean, for what she had to do. I liked the Ray Singh character. There was a couple of really great scenes of dialogue. I thought Susan Sarandon definitely brought her best. Saoirse Ronan was great. You know, if not only for the narration, but other than that, she was great. And I loved the Brian Eno score.
Yes, yes, that was huge.
Because it's so weird. And I think the reason, and I was telling you earlier, I think the reason I did like this movie so much is because it is a weird movie. Like you said, he tries to do a lot and it doesn't really work, but it's so strange. And I just appreciate, like, a lot like Where the Wild Things Are, that DreamWorks would give him $100 million to make this movie. And, you know, just like Warner Brothers gave Spike Jonze $100 or more million to make Where the Wild Things Are, you know, and gave Wes Anderson $40 million to make Fantastic Mr. Fox. And probably all three of these movies will not make the money back, and that's a shame, okay? But well done. You know, I mean, well done to let these kind of, these auteurs, these artists go crazy with all this money. And I respected the movie for that. I mean, because there are some really, really fascinating scenes. Kind of, there's a lot of parallel editing,
yeah, I was gonna say,
which I loved.
Yeah, so, like, I think Peter Jackson does a great job directing, like in terms of, oh, he knows,
right. And there's a lot of places, and like it's digital, right? It's shot digitally, some of it at least. I think all of it actually.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
There was
but,
a cut, like you said, with cuts. Like there's a cut where Stanley Tucci, you know, he builds these houses, these
right.
playhouses.
Like Malden dolls.
Yeah, and so like, then there's a big scene where the investigator comes over and you think he may get caught because he has a...
He has a her bracelet.
Bracelet, yeah. And there's a cut where the investigator's looking inside at his basement in the playhouse, and like, he goes, is this the basement door?
And he opens it, and it's a match cut to the younger salmon girl.
And different things that, like, if another director... Another less prominent, right. You know, less...
Right. I mean, and like, the thing is, and this is a compliment, it's very student filmy in the sense that it's passionate. Like, you know what I mean? Like, cuts like that made me think of, and then this is meant to be a compliment, of movies you watch when you're younger where it just, with limited resources, and obviously there were not limited resources here, but with limited resources, there's magic because of, like, simple stuff like that. And I think Peter Jackson's always been really good at doing stuff like that. Yeah, and like, he uses just a lot of like miniature cameras to get really cool angles. Like, there's a scene where the younger salmon girl is, spoiler alert, so you know, don't listen for 2 seconds if you are listening right now. She sneaks into George Harvey or Stanley Tucci's house when he's gone, which
you,
is one of the best.
Or if you
scenes.
Watch the trailer, you will know.
Oh, so never
the
mind.
The trailer
right.
gives everything.
Exactly. That's true. Which is, that was one of my favorite scenes of the whole right. movie, is when she sneaks into this guy's house. And she opens up the floorboard because she hears like the loose, hollowed out floor. And she finds his notebook with all his like designs for these like forts where he kills the girls and he killed her sister. And the roots that Susie took and everything. And the camera's placed, and her hair, right? And the camera's placed, there is a camera placed in the floorboard. So like when she opens up, you see her hand come down and like find the notebook with her hand, and like shots like that, and there are more than that shot. I mean,
there were a lot of shots like that.
Beautiful.
Though, yeah.
I mean, really, just like beautiful shots. I mean, and kind of harking back to the TFS spotlight we did, show the beauties of digital, because you know you can't really do that with a film camera. So stuff like that really works well. There's a couple really cool Steadicam shots on the actors where they're running. You know, there's one really good one of Stanley Tucci that's in the trailer. You know, and once again, the score, and then whoever does the singing, I don't know the woman who does the singing.
Oh, yeah.
But that was nice.
It's a band that you can... It's a band.
Right, that's right. Oh, yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. You can look it up. So, yeah, there's so much in this movie. That's what it is. There's really so much in this movie that I appreciated it. And so
yeah,
I really did.
I could agree with that. I just didn't. I don't know. Like when I was, it's definitely a compelling movie to watch, and there's a lot of stuff.
Right.
In
I mean, I recommend it just because it is a compelling movie. Yeah. It's more compelling than the story should allow it to be.
Yeah.
Is what
like,
I'll say.
There's every scene has something in it, like right. that you'll get out of. But at the end, I just didn't care at all about.
I mean, that's the thing.
Like, I don't know
there's
what it was
just
trying.
As much problems as there are successes. Like, I mean, and you know, it's funny, I feel like if Mark Wahlberg hadn't been so miscasted, you would be distracted from a decent amount of those problems, because Jack Salmon does play such really a big role. Yeah. Because it's because the Jack Salmon character itself is a hard character to play because he's this kind of this ridiculous optimist as he's in the book. So even after he hears the news of his daughters, he's like his daughter, you know, who goes missing, and they find blood, and it's been a year, and she's probably dead, definitely probably dead. He continues to be pretty optimistic, and it's like stupid almost because people wouldn't be like that, but Mark Wahlberg comes off goofy. It just comes off goofy, and you know, I think he still has a lot of limitations. I mean, he's a good star, you know.
I think it's the Happening effect. Like, after the Happening, anytime he looks at someone, I just get, like, this, like,
weird I don't think of that movie, though. Like, that's the thing. I wasn't thinking of that movie. Like, see, here's the thing. In the beginning of The Lovey Bones, when they're a happy family, I loved Mark Wahlberg because, like, he was a dad. Like, he was a good dad. And, you know, like, I thought of my dad, or your dad. Like, yeah. You know, like, good dads, right? Yeah, the dinner scene. And, that was actually, talking about parallel editing, that was very effective for me. The scene, it's like 25 minutes in when Stanley Tucci's character is luring Susie Salmon into his little hatch underneath the ground. It's cross-cutting with this dinner scene with the Salmons, and Susie's not there. And it's so... And
that's a good example of when cross-cutting works. As we've seen this year, there's been a lot of examples where it hasn't worked.
Right, exactly. Like Law Abiding Citizen, the entire movie. And The Soloist. in that scene, it's beautiful because that really is what the book is, right? That's like the best version you're going to get of the book because it's like the domestication of this world with this horror. You know, so it's like this utopia, family life, essentially, and just like the simplicity of just like the little brother not wanting to eat beans, and they, like, ask for one bean. It's like, oh my god, that's like so a little brother thing to say, like a young something to say. And then it's like George Harvey trying to fucking rape and murder this girl, and it's like, oh my god. And when I was watching that, I actually was watching it at night, and I had to turn it off because it just disturbed me. It really did, because, you know, I have younger siblings, and you have younger siblings, and I was just like, oh my, you know, it makes you think. And if the movie had been more, had more of that kind of raw effect, then it would have been in my top 10. But instead, it's just kind of a failed.
That's a good word to say, Rock, because it feels overproduced almost.
It feels overproduced.
I really wish it was like, you know, 30 million. Right. You know,
yeah, and 20, and you know, you know, it kind of yeah. You know, and you know, and like, here's the thing: if you can make Daybreakers for 20 million, which is, you know, strives nowhere near the ambitions of The Lovely Bones, right? But succeeds far more. Then why can't you make The Lovely Bones for 30 million? I mean, you know, why not? You know, I mean, granted, okay, Mark Wahlberg probably costs more than Ethan Hawke, okay. But aside from that, I mean, it seems a little, it's flabbergasting. Yeah, it's flabbergasting. That'd be the word. Word du jour. So, it's worth checking out because of its flaws and because of its successes. Yeah. But see our first two films before you see The Lovely Bones.
Or, because it goes wide this weekend, so.
And it is better than the book, I will say, from what I've read of it, so.
Alright.
You'll save time by seeing the movie, I guess, if you want to know the story.
Yep. All right. Well, that wraps up our reviews.
Yes, it does.
All right. So, thank you for listening to the Film's Edge podcast. We will be back next week with the Book of Eli review.
Yes. And,
which I'm very excited for.
The Book of Eli.
Right. Yeah. Well, A Single Man. We'll probably
stick that in. Right. Yeah. Definitely.
And we might talk a little about Imaginarium.
Imaginarium would be going to talk about. And also just any Spider-Man updates or any crazy news that happens, any Deadline Hollywood stuff with Mike Fleming.
Yeah, and we are currently hiring writers, and we're going through that process. So if you want to apply, just check out the Film Stage, and you'll see the post right there.
Shoot Jordan an email.
Yeah, shoot us an email, because we'd love to have, you know, we're looking for more writers.
Some samples, goddammit.
Yeah. So thank you guys for listening, and we will be back next week.
Have a good night.